Welcome to Sunday Sermons and other recordings from the Unitarian Universalist Church of Davis, California. Please visit our website at www.uudavis.org for further information.
Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Davis. I'm Emily Burstein, one of the worship associates today.
I'm Steve Burns, also a worship associate today. You are welcome here no matter how you identify. You are welcome here in the fullness of who you are and who you are becoming.
We're very pleased this morning to introduce to you our visiting clergy, Rabbi Seth Castleman. He is ordained as a Jewish rabbi as well as a Buddhist Dharma teacher. And he is director of the Exodus Project, which is an interfaith mentoring program for people coming out of jail. And in your order of service today on the second page, there's a description of the program. And Rabbi Castleman is also the guiding teacher of Mindful Moment Meditation, which is an interfaith group that meets in Davis. And there's a number of folks in our congregation who attend that regularly. And I went for the first time last Tuesday, and it was wonderful. He's married to Reverend Elizabeth Griswold, and they live in Davis with their three children. And some members of our congregation already know Rabbi Castleman, as I said, through his mindful meditation group and also through interfaith events and social justice gatherings. And Seth is going to come up and say a few words.
Thank you, Emily. Thank you, Steve. It's a delight to be here. It's a delight to see so many people on a blustery morning. Being in California from New England, we're used to Unitarians, first of all, we're also used to real weather, and going to church or synagogue or mosque or wherever one worships on a blustery day is sort of par for the course. So a deep bow to you all for making it out, and hopefully you didn't have too much damage to your trees or other such things. So good morning.
To acknowledge all that is being held by the people in this room, we light one pillar candle for the sorrows of the world, for the moments that weigh heavy on our hearts. We light a second pillar candle for the joys of the world, for the moments of hope and celebration. I invite Leanne Friedman to come down to light our chalice. Leanne is a longtime member of the church, one of the co-founders of the Davis Phoenix Coalition, and also is from a Jewish background. In gratitude, we celebrate with open hearts and minds. We discover who we are, separate from each other and within one another. In this circle that holds all life, may we ever work toward widening its boundaries until there are none.
It's nice to see so many young people here this morning, and hopefully by the end of this story, we'll all feel like children on one level. Once upon a time, a long time ago, so long ago it might have been yesterday, there was a little girl that was just about your age, and she lived in a little green house with a red front door, and her name was Natasha. Now, Natasha loved to read. She loved to read all sorts of books. Even though she wasn't very good at reading, she loved to look at books and kind of pretend that she was reading, you see. There was just one problem, and that was Natasha's younger brother. He was a baby, which means whenever Natasha wanted to read, he would go, wee, wee, wee. And Natasha had a hard time concentrating on her books and the words that she did know when her baby brother was crying all the time. So she had arranged with her mother and her father, or maybe two mothers, or maybe two fathers. I don't know Natasha that well. I haven't been to their house, but she arranged with her parents that she could go out the back door and sit in the garden and read there where it was quiet. Or sometimes she had permission to open the back gate, creak, and walk out of the garden and into the woods. And there were big, beautiful trees, just like the live oaks and the redwoods and the madrones and the beautiful trees you have here at the UU. And she would sit down under one of those trees and she would read her book. Well, it was a day kind of like today, just not quite as windy. And Natasha had a special book that was about a princess who was working with the monkeys to try to get back a treasure that the tiger had stolen and hidden. And Natasha was embravened by this story, and she decided to go deeper into the woods than she'd ever gone before. She found a great big tree, and she sat down underneath it, and she leaned her back against the bark, and she started to read. And she read about the princess and the monkeys, and they heard that the tiger had taken the treasure into a cave, and they had to go find it. And just then, Natasha looked up from her book, and what do you think she saw just across the path? A tiger? A monkey? No, it was a cave. And she stood up and she walked across the path and she looked at the cave and she thought, maybe I should go in. Do you think she should go in?
Yes.
Yes, no. It's a personality test. Natasha remembered you should always ask. So she put her head and she said, can I come in? And the voice said, come in, come in, come in, come in, come in. Sounded like an invitation, so Natasha walked into the cave, and it went deeper and deeper and deeper down, until she came into a great big room, much bigger than this room, so big she couldn't see the walls, and in the center, there was a great big circle of children. More children than she'd ever seen. Big children, almost grown-ups, and little children, barely born. There were girls and boys, and dark skin and light skin, and big ears and small ears, and short noses and long noses. And they were all sitting in a circle. And in the middle of the circle was a giant pile of food. More food than you could ever imagine. In fact, it was all the food that you could imagine. There was pizza, there was rice, there was beans, there was ice cream, there were cookies. What other food was there?
Pot roast.
Pot roast. Fruit. What else?
Broccoli.
Tofu. And sprinkled on the top were M&Ms and chocolate chips. And Natasha started to feel a grumbling in her stomach and a little drool in the corner of her mouth, and she wanted to go over and eat some, but then she noticed that none of the children seemed to be eating. So without thinking about it, she said, why doesn't anybody eat? For they all looked hungry. And suddenly, thousands of eyes turned and looked at her. She felt very nervous. Then one of the big boys stood up. He reached over and he picked up an apple from the middle of the pile and he tried to eat it like this. And when he couldn't eat it, he put it down and sadly and hungrily he sat back down. For you see, this was the cave of the children without elbows. Now, if you don't have feet, you can imagine it would be hard to walk. And if you don't have eyes, it's hard to see. But imagine if you don't have elbows, it's very hard to get the food to your mouth. Now, Natasha, she had elbows. She could go and pick something up and put it right in her mouth. But it didn't seem fair for her to eat when all the other children couldn't. What could Natasha do? If you're under the age of 10, do you have any suggestions? She could give the food to them, but there's like 1,000 of them. Could she feed all of them? It's a great idea. Did you have an idea? She could find a bunch of other kids and bring them into the cave, but she didn't know if she could do that in the 3.5 minutes in which she's supposed to tell the story and be home in time for dinner. You know, they all could reach their heads in and just sort of put their faces down and eat, like, but there was a loud bonk as all the heads kind of bonked each other. Or maybe they could just kind of throw the food into their mouths. And Natasha looked around and it seemed like they tried that because some of the kids had M&Ms in their ears and one had a raisin up his nose. So that didn't work. But if Natasha could feed just that one boy, maybe all the other kids could do the same thing. And Natasha picked up that apple, and she pretended she didn't have an elbow, and she reached out, and she held it in front of that boy's mouth. And that boy looked down at the apple and looked over at Natasha, then looked back at the apple, and he took a bite. and it was so good, and the juice ran down his chin. And suddenly everybody else got the same idea, and everybody asked their neighbor, what do you want to eat? What do you want to eat? And everybody picked up the food, and they handed it to each other. And there was suddenly a big sound that you could help me with. And then there was another big sound. And when they'd all finished and they'd wiped their chins off, Natasha read them their book, the book that she brought down, because the kids hadn't been very good at reading. It's hard when you're a little kid to read with the book so far away, although it's kind of easier when you're older to read with the book so far away. And when she finished the chapter, she waved goodbye to all the kids, and they all waved goodbye back at her. And then she walked back out of the cave, and she walked through the woods, and she opened the gate, creak, and she walked into the garden and inside the house, and what did she hear? But somehow it didn't bother her quite as much, as she felt connected to all those children and even to her baby brother and maybe to all the world. And that night, Natasha taught her family how to eat spaghetti like this. And that's the end of the story.
Aside from my family, this church community is the most important group I belong to, and also is an important part of my identity. What makes this community sacred to me is that I feel it is worthy of awe and respect. As I gradually came to know this community, the elders and founders slowly became my heroes. Their perspectives were worthy of study, and their robust engagement with world issues was inspiring. I knew that some of our prior leaders and founders had been involved with human rights or civil rights for decades. Some had seen firsthand the horrors of war in Germany, or had fled the Nazis and made a new home in America. Most remained active in important causes for their entire life, whether it was voting rights, environmental action, eliminating capital punishment, or righting the wrongs of U.S. intervention in Central America. There were always examples of those who didn't just talk the talk, but walked the walk. Many of you who have attended here for decades can probably attach faces of our members to each of these causes. If you had told me in my 20s or early 30s that I would be regularly attending memorial services and be in the church every Sunday, I would have thought your crystal ball was cloudy. But as my immersion in this community deepened, the importance of showing up grew along with my involvement. A friend had told me that she was quite bad at writing letters of condolences, but when her partner had died, the outpouring from the church friends had greatly buoyed her spirits, and she saw how important these small acts can be for those newly in grief. Even at memorial services for people who I didn't know very well, I often find great depth in their life and see how they impacted others. Today is a memorial wall service for those in our community who have died in the last year, and I will be there, as I feel it is a sacred duty to be present to support those who loved them.
When I joined the UU Church in 2013, I was looking for community, but not necessarily a sacred one. I come from a secular Jewish family that was not comfortable with organized religion or words like sacred. My father believed that organized religion often divided people. However, the UU Church welcomed me with concepts that felt humanistic and comfortable for my own background, concepts like the inherent worth and dignity of every person, a community of sharing and caring, and social justice in action. At the UU Church, I felt immediately swathed in kindness, acceptance, and moral clarity. I wondered, how did these people get to be so nice? I learned they took their values from diverse religious, spiritual, and humanistic traditions. And slowly I recognized the powerful aspects of religious tradition that can bring people together in love, hope, and acceptance. My sister-in-law lived with terminal cancer for 6 years and recently passed away. She'd been a devout Catholic, which had seemed to me rule-bound and tied to an oppressive patriarchal system. But as she faced cancer, I saw how her deep faith blessed her with gratitude and discipline and equanimity. As she neared death, I was moved to honor her by bringing her into my sacred places. I was sure this would give her comfort. For the first time, I wrote in our church's milestone book, and I lit a candle in the back. And then when attending the Jewish High Holiday this services, I participated also for the first time in the ancient ritual of saying the names out loud of those who needed healing. I had always liked the ritual, but somehow could never raise my voice. So this time, as the rabbi held out his hand, I said her name, and I felt the ritual's link to so many faith traditions. I now savor a sense of sacred community in many unexpected places. In a yoga class with a wise teacher, gliding on a kayak, in a kayak in Lake Solano with a friend who I'm looking at right now, or touching the hand of a loved one or a stranger. I first understood sacred community at UUCD, and then I saw these communities all around me.
There's an old adage that you may have heard about one spiritual mountain and many paths up it. It's nice, it's trite, it never quite worked for me. I always felt like it sort of didn't acknowledge or it disrespected the distinctions and the differences between the different faith traditions. So in my mind, I think of it more as a mountain range. You've got your Buddhist mountain and your Christian mountain, your Jewish mountain, your Unitarian mountain, your Muslim mountain. All of them start in different places. And at the base of a mountain, one may start in the tundra, another may start in the desert. But as you get higher and higher, the peaks of all the mountains are more and more alike. So that fundamentalism is when we base our ideas on the base of a mountain and say, well, I know a true mountain is my mountain, and that one, you start with an ice axe and crampons and a snowsuit, and you in sandals and a t-shirt in the desert clearly are not climbing a true mountain. And there are different stories, and there are different foods, and there are different prayers, and there are different traditions in the different faith traditions. But the mystics who climb to the top, my senses are experiencing very much of the same thing. Just as if you climb to a great altitude on any mountain, on any continent, you have view. You have little air. The one thing you can't see is your own true mountain, your own mountain. Perhaps a teaching in its own right about how the path is different from fruition, mountain climbing and spiritually. And while the mystics don't say much in the different faith traditions, perhaps they're all not talking about pretty much the same thing. One of the things that's important in all faith traditions, at the base especially, is community. In the Jewish tradition, sometimes the spiritual path is compared to a tree. And a tree of three parts. The trunk, which would represent our connection to ourself and having a deeper connection to ourself, which in fact often leads to not more importance about yourself, but less importance about yourself. That the more and more we connect with ourselves, the less and less our ego has control over who we are and how we think. The second being the roots of the tree, which would represent the community, the tradition, the ancestors. And the third being the branches or the connection to the divine, or however you imagine the mystery to be. And in faith traditions, like as in most trees, the branches or the connection to the divine will only grow as wide as the roots or the connection to community, or else that tree will tip over when the slightest of winds come along, let alone today's winds. So I'd like to speak this morning and into mid to late afternoon, if you'll have me, about community, the sacred community. The Zen monk and poet Thich Nhat Hanh has a teaching that the next Buddha that will be born into this world will not be an individual, but will be a community, or a sangha, as we say in the Buddhist language. The Jewish version of that same teaching is about the coming of the Messiah, that the Messiah will come when we all act in godly, holy ways. But my understanding of that is not that we act all good and kind and then somebody comes waltzing through the door on a white donkey or however it might be according to the myth or the tradition. I see it as that when we start acting in holy and godly ways, we start to see the Messiah in everyone we meet. The Messiah will already be here once we start acting that way. And once we start creating that type of community. As Steve and Emily both spoke so eloquently about, community can happen on many levels. And in some ways it starts with family. And family, of course, starts with our family of origin. Sometimes I think that our faith and our faith community is kind of like a family of origin. You kind of like it. And there's parts of it you really kind of don't like, but you can't really get away from it because it's your tradition and it's your family, right? And then there's the family that we create in our own lives. My family, my wife and I, and our now three kids, as we're in the process of adopting a third little girl right now. We are a family of quite a bit of faith, being a rabbi and a minister. Married together, I joke that we argue about a lot of things, but not about religion. The dishes and everything else, sure, we'll argue quite a bit about, but Lila, our oldest, and Abraham, our youngest, were getting into a bit of a spat some months ago, and Abraham, the 2-year-old, was pestering the 6-year-old, and she came storming into the kitchen where my wife was, and she said, "I can't stand him. He's, I can't even say it. He's just, oh." And Elizabeth asked her to calm down and take some deep breaths, and then she asked, on a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 is the worst and 10 is the best, where would you put Abraham, your little brother, right now? She said, "Oh, it's terrible. I think he's only a 9. It speaks to the level of love and compassion that's possible in our own hearts. When I look at my daughter, now 2 daughters and son, and see how much they love each other, at least some of the time. If we could only knock each other down from a 10 to a 9 when things get really bad, I think we'd be doing pretty well. Lila, for a school project recently for first grade, had to draw a picture of her community. And she showed me the picture before she turned it in, and it had a house in the middle, and it said Lila in it. And then there was a pathway that led over, and there was a picture of the synagogue, and a pathway that led to my wife's church, and a picture of that. And then she had different friends and their houses and pathways that led to that, and the N Street co-housing community here in Davis that we're a part of, and a pathway to that. She was at the center, which is where every child should consider themselves, and every adult needs to stop thinking of themselves. And all these different aspects of her life made up her community. We have family, we have friends, we have social communities, work communities, we have the faith community that we're a part of. Being part of a faith community is about offering many things. It's about showing up, it's about giving of your different resources, but it's also about receiving. And being loved by those that are in your community and allowing that love to touch you. Just as when Steve was talking about a member of the community receiving letters for bereavement. I'm reminded of an old joke about spiritual community. A Muslim, a Christian, and a Jew who all ended up on a deserted island after a shipwreck. And when they gathered themselves together and they figured out their circumstances, they each stood up to pray, and the Christian crossed himself and prayed to God and asked for salvation for all the world, and especially for the three of them, may they be saved from this island. And the Muslim bowed down and prayed to Allah and prayed for the salvation of all people and also for the three of them to be saved from this island. And the Jew sat there and said his prayers or her prayers and asked for goodness and love to go throughout all the world, and then stopped. And the Christian and the Muslim looked at the Jew and said, "Aren't you going to pray for our getting saved from this island? We're kind of stuck here." And the Jew looked at the other two and said, "You know, I retired a few years ago after my wife had a very successful career and made quite a bit of money, and we joined a new synagogue. And the first year, we pledged $10,000 at pledge time. And last year, the second year we were there, we upped that to $50,000. Our pledges are due in 2 days. I think they're going to fine me." And part of being a faith community is giving of your time and your talent and your treasure. And knowing that it's only through our good works together that good things come about. People give of all different ways, and even in the hardest of circumstances. I know from my work in prison, seeing some of the most generous acts of loving kindness happen right there in the prison and in the jail. I remember going into a facility when I was living in New York on September 11th in 2001 and was working as a chaplain at Ground Zero. And then some weeks later when I was done and went back to the prison work, and the women inmates saying that they had sent money for the survivors. And they had collected money from the little bit of money they had in their fund for cigarettes and food and such, and had taken that money and had donated it. People give in all sorts of ways, and it makes us feel more connected as a community. As the psychiatrist Viktor Frankl, who survived Auschwitz, put it, "We who lived in concentration camps can remember the men and women who walked through the huts, comforting others, giving away their last piece of bread. They may have been few in number, but they offer sufficient proof that everything can be taken away from someone, but one thing, the last of human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given circumstances, to choose one's own way through life." As a spiritual community, we have the opportunity to practice how we are going to go through our life. We get to practice and then come back the next week, or come to meetings during the week, or get involved in activism and make mistakes along the way, but hope and pray that we'll be forgiven and we'll get the opportunity to try again. I said hope and pray. It reminds me of a Native American teacher of mine, Fred Wapapa, from the Bay Area, who I used to sit a lot of sweat lodges with and go on vision quests with. And I remember once during a ceremony, as we were having the meal afterwards, he said to me, "You know, in our language, there is no word for hope." And I said, "Huh, that's interesting. Why is that?" He said, "There's no word for hope because we understand that things are just as they should be right now." Well, to say that as an elder of a community that suffered the worst genocide ever in human history, where 99% of the Native Americans were decimated, is a pretty remarkable thing. To say that we understand the world is as it should be just now, and that things will continue to get better. This is the power of hope. And Fred reminds me of the power of our teachers and our elders, the power of our spiritual community, those that we know and also those that we take inspiration from, but that we don't necessarily personally know. They can inspire us to lead deeper, holier lives. When I spent about a year and a half in Asia doing meditation practice, I spent a few months as a monk in Burma, and in the midst of it, I was in a funk as a monk. and was in a bit of a deep depression and struggled a lot with my practice. And one evening, my teacher took me outside and pointed to the mountains that surround the monastery. And he said, "You see those hills? There are monks and nuns and caves up in those hills. And they're all meditating. They're all doing loving kindness practice. And they're sending loving kindness to you." And he stuck his finger right in my chest. And he said, "And the worst of it is, you deserve it." And of all the people that I met in my travels and studies and practice, those nameless, faceless monks and nuns are perhaps the ones that have stuck with me the most. We can connect with not only our faith community, but the universal family, the universal community of people, and the universal community of nature. For many of us, we have our deepest spiritual experiences in the world of nature, sitting out under a tree, on a mountaintop, by the ocean. I'm reminded of the environmental activist Greta Thunberg from Sweden, who recently gave that speech to the UN, where she said, "You say you hear us, that you understand the urgency when speaking about environmental destruction and global warming. But no matter how sad and angry I am," she went on, "I do not want to believe that. Because if you really understood the situation and still kept on failing to act, then you would be evil. And I refuse to believe that." This is that level of hope and faith that is sometimes required as we live as a spiritual community, as a world community. She went on to say, "We will not let you get away with this. Right here, right now, is where we draw the line. The world is waking up and change is coming, whether you like it or not." Change is coming. It's always coming. The question is whether it's going to be change for the good or change for more suffering. As the author Gabriel Garcia Marquez put it, human beings are not born once on the day their mothers gave birth to them, for life obliges them over and over, again and again, to give birth to themselves. I see this rebirth in the mentoring work that I do with people that are in prison and in jail and coming out back to their communities, to our communities. And I see it not just in the formerly incarcerated returning citizens, but also in the mentors that have the opportunity to serve, to be a spiritual friend, to be a mentor, to be a guide in worldly things of finding housing and employment, but also internal things, the spiritual, the psychological, even the religious. We do happen to be looking for more mentors, if you might be interested. I'll wait for the first three volunteers to stand up. Hallelujah. Praise God. Whether it's with inmates, whether it's in our faith community, whether it's in our family, or whether it's just with ourselves, perhaps the most important element for deepening spiritual practice is the practice of forgiveness. And forgiving oneself and loving oneself is quite possibly half the spiritual journey. Living in community, of course, is a practice of forgiving one another. Inside ourselves and between each other. As I remember my rabbi teaching when I was 5 years old, you can't ask the divine, you can't ask God for forgiveness until you've gone to your friend and neighbor and enemy and asked for forgiveness. May we take time to reflect with honesty on our own actions, on our own intentions. May we forgive our neighbors for their actions, for their intentions. And in the words of the poet W.B. Auden, may we love our crooked neighbor with all our crooked heart.
We extinguish the pillar candle symbolizing our sorrows. May they be lightened. We extinguish the pillow candle of our joys. May they continue to spread and grow. And we extinguish the flame of the chalice. May we bring brightness, compassion, and resiliency to the world.
I invite you, if you feel comfortable, to either hold hands or put a hand on the shoulder of the person next to you as we connect ourselves as a community. May you be blessed by the divine with wholeness and peace. May you be blessed with the sacred community that is in your heart and in your lives. May you take these blessings out into the world so that all beings may be so blessed. Amen. Amen.